the wonder of Christmas. And as we reflect on that, that builds up. So I love this season of Advent. Christmas is that great theme of darkness and light. I assume that's one of the reasons the church eventually decided in the Northern Hemisphere that it was going to celebrate Christmas in the middle of winter. A midwinter Christmas festival at the darkest time of the year seemed appropriate for that theme of darkness with the light intersecting with it. And so as we read the gospel accounts, we think of the shepherds in the fields watching their flocks by night, the sudden intrusion of the heavenly host. We think of the wise men following the star visible in the night sky, the supernatural colliding of the divine with the natural world, light shining into darkness. But this morning I'd like us to park Christmas on one side just for a moment. We may come back to that a bit later on, but for the moment let's park Christmas. And I wanted to take you on a journey, a history journey, because I love history, particularly when it's biblical history. And particularly we've got this amazing verse from Isaiah, lovely Old Testament prophet, a great piece of Old Testament writing, and we want to explore that. But I wanted to take us back to Isaiah's time, back into the mists of time, back to the last 30 years or so of the 8th century BC, so roughly 2,700 years ago. The Middle East is our location, probably not much different from the Middle East today. It's a region racked with conflict. Conflict and conquest, but different groups involved from the groups today. The dominant power in the Middle East is Assyria. And so there we have a map showing the Assyrian Empire sitting up there on the top right. Actually, I've got this little pointer thing here. There we go. Thank you, Mike. But we can see there that Assyria is a pretty big nation, and around the 8th century it was becoming an increasing threat to the smaller nations of the region. And so just in terms of the people, Rezin, who was king of Syria, allied himself with Pekah, who was then the king of Israel, the northern kingdom of the Jews. So if we just go back there, we can see over here Syria, and then Samaria there is the northern kingdom of Israel. And Assyria was beginning to become a threat to those people. So Rezin, the king of Syria, decided to enter into an alliance with Pekah, who was the king of Israel. In their turn, they decided they were going to put pressure on the southern kingdom of Judah. Remember that Israel is two people, Israel, Judah. 10 tribes, 2 tribes, okay? Capital of Israel is Samaria, capital of Judah is Jerusalem. Okay, cool. You've got it. Okay, so they decided to put pressure on Judah. So let's go back and just have a look at that map again. So we've got Syria and Samaria putting pressure on Jerusalem. And Jotham, who was king in Judah at that time, resisted the pressure, but then he died and his son Ahaz came to the throne. And we can read about Ahaz in the second book of Kings, chapter 16. I just thought I'd whistle through this stuff because I like this, you're going to have to put up with it. Part of doing this, though, is part of what I love about opening the scriptures is trying to help you to open the scriptures for yourselves and make sense of them. So when we come on here to the beginning of 2 Kings chapter 16, this is a formulaic statement from the book of Kings. If you ever read Kings, you'll find it's a bit like this. So the 17th year of Pekah, son of Remaliah, King Ahaz, son of Jotham of Judah, began to reign. So Ahaz is now king of Judah in the south. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. He did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his ancestor David had done, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even made his son pass through fire according to the abominable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. He sacrificed and made offerings on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. So was Ahaz a good king? No. Okay, so you'll get the formula from 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Kings. This is the formula that describes a bad king. He doesn't walk in the ways of God. So Judah, which is the more godly of the two nations, with the capital in Jerusalem, has got a less than godly king. He's a bounder in the common language, I suppose, of today. So Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, king of Israel, head south into Judah this time with an army, and they laid siege to Jerusalem. And so Ahaz, king of Judah, against all the advice of everybody wise around him, decides that he's going to ask for help. And so he sends messengers to Assyria, the superpower of the region, and he asks for help. So if we go back, we can see that the king of Assyria at the time, the capital was Nineveh, and the king was Tiglath-Pileser. So Ahaz digs through all his treasury, through the temple, finds every bit of gold and silver he can find, puts it in buckets, and sends it off to the king of Assyria, and says, "Would you come to my help?" And he's more than delighted to do so, because he wants to expand his territory. So the Assyrian troops invade Syria and destroy Damascus. And then in their turn, they turn their attention to Israel and they besieged Samaria, which eventually fell in 722 BC. So you've got this change of power in the area. I don't know if we can really find Judah is down there, Jerusalem, and so Damascus in the middle there and Samaria are now fallen and they are part of Assyria. And what they did in those days, when they invaded and conquered someone, they carted all the people off out of the province and then they replaced them with their own people. So suddenly, out of the people of Israel, piece of history for you here, out of the people of Israel, the 12 tribes, effectively the 10 tribes have been disbanded all over the region. So the territory of Israel, Canaan, that God gave to his people, no longer is inhabited by 10/12 of the people. So the Assyrians invaded Syria, they invaded, and so of course they become a threat to Judah in the south. The people of Judah were understandably very nervous, and Ahaz had managed to achieve relative peace, but what was the ongoing cost going to be? He then died, and he was succeeded by his son Hezekiah. A little bit about Hezekiah: trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was no one like him among all the kings of Judah after him, or among those who were before him, for he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded. So is Hezekiah a good king? He's a good king. Okay, in fact, he's a very good king according to this. Hezekiah, we tend to read about and hear about a little bit, so much so that people often think there is a book in the Old Testament called the Book of Hezekiah. And just to disabuse you, there isn't. He's a king in Israel. Okay, so we've got Hezekiah on the throne in Judah. Of course, if you forged an alliance with a superpower and then you renege on it, you can expect trouble. And so in Assyria then invaded again. I'm going to leave you to find out what happened to all that. Not going to tell you about that this morning because I want to get into Isaiah. But if you look at 2 Kings chapters 18, 19, and 20, and Isaiah chapters 36 to 39, I'll put it on Facebook if you want, they're really good passages to read. So worth looking at those to see what happens next in the story. The picture, though, that I'm hoping you're getting is that this was a dark time for the people of Judah. This is the people to whom Isaiah is prophesying. This is a dark time, an uncertain time. Assyria is threatening. Is Hezekiah going to be able to protect the nation of Judah and protect Jerusalem against this massive Assyrian invasion that is looming large? So let's park the history, put that on one side along with Christmas, and come into Isaiah. Because into this whole situation, there is the voice. There is the voice of promise, the voice of a prophet. And this is what Isaiah writes in chapter 9. "Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress." This is a promise. This is amazing, isn't it? There will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he, God, humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. That's the land in the north. That's the kingdom of Israel that's disappeared. He humbled those lands. But in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations. So that area will be honored by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You've enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time forth, of that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Now just imagine for a moment that you are there in the kingdom of Judah. Maybe you're a humble merchant or whatever in Jerusalem, and you've got this looming threat from Assyria. And there's a sense of darkness, confusion, and uncertainty. And into this, Isaiah speaks these words. These are words of hope, aren't they? These are words of possibility, words of a future, words of something that is to come that gives hope for life. So these people have this no-hope political scene, but they've also lost their way spiritually. They've had Ahaz, the bad king, as king for the last years. And they don't know what to do. They don't know how to turn to God. They've lost the plot as far as God is concerned. But then into this, Isaiah speaks, there'll be no more darkness for those who were in trouble. God did bring all of this trial and tribulation on the lands of Zebulun and Naphtali, but this will be addressed. The time is coming when he'll make that area glorious. King Ahaz chose his way rather than God's way, trusting in human glory rather than depending on God. And so he's helped to plunge the nation into darkness. But it's against this background that Isaiah speaks. And when God speaks, he speaks. Isaiah predicts that one day in the future, these people who are walking and stumbling will see a great light. They live in a land of shadows, but in the future, light will shine on them. God will give them joy. They will rejoice. Light will come out of darkness. God's glory will come to his people in the form of a baby boy, a baby who will grow to be a ruler, and whose name will be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. God's going to achieve this influx of light through the birth of a child. But who is this child? That is the question. We would expect, along with the people of Isaiah's time, that probably Isaiah was prophesying the birth of a new human king for Israel. A new rule or reign would come about, and the people of Judah would be safe from destruction. Could this maybe be a prophecy that relates to the birth of Hezekiah himself, the good king who was going to lead his people in defiance of the Assyrian army? I'll just give you a hint to encourage you to read on, that they do withstand the Assyrians, and the Assyrians do go home with their tail between their legs. So it's got a good outcome. So is this a prophecy for the reign of Hezekiah? There doesn't seem to be anyone else around on the scene at that time, in the time of the 8th century, who could maybe fit into these shoes. And I guess if Hezekiah was the one referred to, it's possible that this section out of Isaiah might actually be an enthronement song from his coronation. It might be a song that was sung, but people rejoicing, and here's Hezekiah, the godly king, and this was their expression of hope in him. It was a prediction of the good that was to come as he ascended the throne. The one who has been born, and upon whose shoulders now rests the governing of the nations. Was this prophecy being fulfilled in Isaiah's time with King Hezekiah? But as we look back, Hezekiah's reign ended in disappointment. He was only human after all. Wise government was shown, but it was not sustained. Isaiah 9:7 said, of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. And that wasn't the case with Hezekiah. Ultimately, he did not deliver. But of course, as we know, as we look at Old Testament prophecy, so often it has an immediate application, but it also has an application in times to come. There's a fulfillment of a prophecy to come over the horizon. And that's how Matthew, the writer of the first gospel, saw it. If you're familiar with Matthew's gospel, in chapter 4 he says, Jesus withdrew to Galilee. He left Nazareth and made his home in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali. We've just heard about them, haven't we, in Isaiah? These lands that had been desolated by the Assyrian invasion. Jesus made his home in Capernaum, in that territory, so that what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali, on the road by the sea across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. Is this the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy? Matthew is pointing the readers of his time that this is what Jesus was. Jesus had come to fulfill. And that whole theme is taken up again at the beginning of John's gospel. In the beginning was the Word was with God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him. Without him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. The gospel writers are so clear that here in Jesus is the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. And of course, Georg Friedrich Händel had no doubt that Isaiah's prophecy was indeed a messianic promise, as he included it, as we saw at the start of our service, in that amazing piece of work that Andrew and his team are going to be singing for the City of Christchurch next Saturday, The Messiah. Thank you, Andrew. But as we think about Isaiah's prophecy, the names given to this child are out of this world in extravagance, aren't they? What human leader could ever fulfill the description we read in Isaiah? Ultimately, for the New Testament writers and for us in the 21st century, the prelude here in the prelude to Christmas, Isaiah's prophecy realizes its ultimate fulfillment in Christ. And so Christ is the wonderful counselor. Of course, I'm sure we all know that Handel got it wrong in the libretto of his oratorio. He got his grammar wrong, Andrew, didn't he? I'm thinking about his depiction of Isaiah 9, verse 6, and his name shall be called, da 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 da. He says, wonderful counselor. Yes, he puts a comma after the wonderful. Wonderful counselor, mighty God, everlasting Father. He gets it right for the rest, but the first one, he puts that comma in there. And we've got this idea that Jesus, his name will be wonderful counselor. But in fact, it's a wonderful counselor. He's going to be a wise governor, not a counselor in terms of therapy sessions, but a counselor in terms of executing policy, administering, governing, leading and guiding. He's going to be a wise ruler. And wonderful suggests he's going to be an extraordinarily wise ruler. He will have extraordinary wisdom, extraordinary foresight. His plans, his policies will be of exceptional quality. This king will dazzle in his rule and reign. Isaiah himself suggests that this wonderful character would be rooted in the character and nature of Almighty God. There's just a little bit that appears in Isaiah 28 where he writes that God is wonderful in counsel and excellent in wisdom. In Isaiah's mind, there is a linking of this prophecy to something of God, something that is only of God. God is the wonderful counselor, the one who is the holder of extraordinary wisdom, which is what the New Testament writers saw as they extracted these extravagant claims and applied them to Jesus. Jesus, the long-expected king, also born in a time of turmoil within the threat of Rome. The gospel writers saw in Jesus the wonderful counselor. He was wise. He was insightful. He penetrated beyond conventional assumptions. He showed amazing discernment about how the world works. He understood people and their motivations. He saw through their masks. The people in Jesus' time repeatedly asked where he obtained his wisdom and his insight. Even as a child, his wisdom was to be seen. It was noteworthy, it was extraordinary. But Jesus was extraordinary too in his teaching. We're told of people's amazement at his understanding and the way he answered questions, the way he taught as one with authority, not as the other religious leaders. His teaching that attested to the possibility of God that the world of his time had long since thought to be impossible. He painted a picture of a kingdom, the kingdom of God, God's rule, God's reign, a topsy-turvy kingdom where the first are going to be last and the last are going to be first. A kingdom where the least, the lost, and the lonely have significance and status. A kingdom where those who mourn who are blessed, where those who are poor are to be regarded. A kingdom where the leaders of Jesus' time, which the leaders of Jesus' time rejected, afraid that it would overturn the social order. They saw him as dangerous and subversive. The crowds, the people, though, were spellbound by the possibilities he was opening up for them. So Jesus, wise and extraordinary in his teaching, was also wise and extraordinary in his actions, in his healing, in his the casting out of demons, in setting people free from bondage. God's kingdom is a kingdom of broad horizons, filled with possibilities and with hope. And Jesus' wisdom is seen in the invitation to participate. The invitation to us to participate and continue as his followers, to continue his way of subversive astonishment and transformation in the world, to continue his seeking for alternatives to conventional power and government, to continue to stand up for the underdog and to be willing to be seen as troublemakers in the process of turning the world upside down. This is what we have been invited to do. Where does Jesus fit into our context, into our lives? What part do we allow this wonderful counselor to take in our lives? Is he our wise ruler, or do we shut him out, unwilling to surrender full control and to do anything that he wants to do within us? I quite like what Walter Brueggemann writes in relation to this. He says, "It turns out that recognition of this new king is not just a Christmas Eve lark. It constitutes a new vocation. It's not only an acknowledgement of his new rule in the world, but a recruitment for action congruent with the new regime." Think about this, friends. This is what Christmas is about. It's a recruitment for action congruent with a new regime that Jesus came to bring. The increase of his government will not be by supernatural imposition or by royal fiat. Instead, it will come about through the daily intentional engagement of his subjects, who are so astonished by his wonder that they no longer subscribe to the old order of power and truth that turns out to be, in the long run, only debilitating fraudulence. It requires an uncommon wisdom to interrupt the foolish practice of business as usual. So I guess there's our challenge as we come into this season of Advent. What are we going to do with Jesus? Are we going to somehow or other leave him chained by our expectations and our limitations? Or are we going to see him as one who has recruited us to be part of something that is radical and life-changing? Where is light intersecting into the darkness of our world this Christmas? Could it be through us? Chris. Do you want to play with this as we finish, or have you seen enough?
I'm good. Well, maybe. How do you do that thing?
This one. It's that one there. Do you press that there and point it?
Oh.
Isn't that amazing? We are just so indebted to Mike. Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Konami's been round and you guys have prayed over it, so I'll give it to Helen now. Helen, this gift from Ireland as our recognition. Of God's call, our recognition of God's call, God's passion, God's gifting, and God's anointing on your life. It comes with our prayers that you would continue to listen and respond to the invitation to follow Christ and to play your part in life.
Hello. Yeah, it's been an awesome time this morning, and it's been really great to share so many aspects of God with us. I'm going to conclude with a classic carol, Once in Royal David's City. We're just going to do a short version. I think here at Ireland, for reasons that are sort of beyond me, we don't sing the verses about Victorian moralism and how kids should behave and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, if you want to, you know, teach your kids at home that, but feel free. But we're just going to do a short version of Once in Royal David's City. Then we've got a benediction to conclude. And then please stick around for lunch. All right, let's start.